Welcome back. We're beginning the fifth and final hour of this Halloween extravaganza. And what a program it's been. We've had great guests, great calls, and we've had a lot of people, well over 100 at the peak. A lot of them dropped off as soon as International Megan's Law ended. Isn't that interesting, Mr. Producer? Why did that happen?
Considering how few of the number of our people can travel, I don't know why that's such the hot topic. That's my personal opinion. I don't mean to offend anybody if that is your hot button, but I don't get it.
Oh, so yeah, the call load plummeted as soon as we finished that segment. But we are beginning the final hour, and one little bit of housekeeping. We're going to have King Alexander, who I'm going to introduce in a moment formally. And we're going to have the final opportunity for you to enter the prize contest. In order that the number is correct, if you have not already texted prize, text prize to this number.
747-227-4477.
And if you are in the middle of something Halloween related that we would want to know, text report to what number?
747-227-4477.
And we will get you on as quickly as possible. We have no way of knowing who's in the queue for what because we don't have the ability to screen calls. If you get in the queue, you get on. And how long you stay on depends on how much background noise there is and how relevant your discussion is to the topic. This hour is going to be related to internet restrictions that are imposed by whatever authority, be it a state statute, be it a probation or parole or a federal supervised release, anything that inhibits your ability to be on the internet. It's not going to be focused much on the social media restrictions that the media companies impose themselves. I mean, we can go there, but that's not the purpose of this. We're trying to deal with statutory stuff. We have King Alexander, who joined us in the third hour, who's here for this final hour. King is a supervising attorney in the Calcasieu Parish Public Defender's Office, supervises attorneys who defend people who are facing life without parole. That's some pretty serious stuff. Now, do you defend people who are facing death?
No, I don't. That's a specialty that the Dream Team comes in. We have in Louisiana some nonprofits that have death penalty certified attorneys that handle all of those cases.
So if they're going to go to life without parole, you're good enough for that, but you're not good enough to save them from the needle. That's a very specialized.
Well, I went through all the training for it, and I had nothing left to do but to sit second chair for death penalty cases. And a friend of mine who practiced death penalty invited me to do that. But my boss actually forbade any of us to become death penalty certified because then the courts would start appointing us on death penalty cases. And if they appointed us on one case, that would be the destruction of our office. It's very expensive. It's very all-consuming. And it's best left in the hands of those specialists and those nonprofits that have funding that we don't have.
Well, in addition to all that, King is on as co-chair of the Louisiana Criminal Defense Lawyers, LACDL, although I never hear anybody say that, association. So he reviews amicus briefs for them. And he also is on our less formal amicus committee, and we send a lot of stuff his way. So he's a very valuable asset to Norsalt.
Well, thank you. And nothing about being admitted in 3 states and 8 federal courts. No, I'm just kidding. I appreciate the build up there. But yeah, LACDL. Yeah, that sounds too much like lactation. So I think they just say LACDL, but I've been doing amicus I've been the senior co-chair for about 10 years and on it for a little bit longer than that. And we always have one pending applications to the U.S. Supreme Court quite often.
And he's also politically active, and he serves on the State Central Committee of one of the two dominant political parties in Louisiana. Well, of course, there's only one really dominant political party.
Louisiana does that. It used to be that it was always the Democratic Party, and now it's there's a Democrat governor now. But I did manage to get the resolution through for Louisiana to have unanimous verdicts. And the vote on that is Tuesday on November the 6th, and it looks like it'll pass.
And that's for those who don't understand, Louisiana does not require unanimous jury verdicts. And are you the only state, or is there one other state that way?
Oregon also, but Louisiana is the only state that uses non-unanimous verdicts for cases that carry life without parole. And that's every case that I try, because it's the more serious felonies, believe it or not, that they do that. The lesser felonies have what they call six-pack juries, that the U.S. Supreme Court already said you can't have 5 out of 6 verdicts because that's not enough jurors. But they say that there's enough jurors on a 10 out of 12. But anyone who defends knows that the important number is how many do I have to convince in order to stop the mob. And anyone who defends knows that it's much better to only have to convince one to stop the mob versus three, you know.
Well, King, what I'm going to do is I've been itching for a report from New Mexico, and I'm going to take the report, and I'm going to actually take the call. There's one more in the queue that was held over, so I still see you there. And the other person, if you want to be in the queue, you can certainly get back in there, *6. But this is a person in New Mexico who will remain nameless for his own protection, but he has been holding for 151 minutes now. So very patiently waiting to tell us what's going on in New Mexico. So Mr. Anonymous from Eastern New Mexico, you're on Narsil in Action with King Alexander, and we have reports that you have been forced to report to a detention facility for a couple of years now. Is that true?
Yes, that is true. 3 years running now. Before we get into all that, I just want to thank all of you all for your valiant efforts and the things you do. You're so greatly appreciated by many of us, and I'm sure you don't hear it enough. So, yes, 3 years running, we have been required to report to a facility for a five-hour lockdown. Now, keep in mind that I live in a rural community in New Mexico. I live in
Don't name the community, because we don't want them zeroing too much if they're listening. But okay.
Right. Well, my point is I do not live in the city limits, so there is no trick-or-treating going on out here in the country. We live in the country. We have a fence around our property and two gates that remain closed at all times. So for the past 3 years running, they've required us to load up and go to the nearest large city with the parole office, which is about 90 miles from here. It's a round trip. It's about 180 miles. So the first year it was pretty relaxed. There's about 30 of us, SOs from that city and local outlying rural communities. The first year they allowed us to play cards and play dominoes and watch television and whatnot. And that first year, until someone passed out Narsil literature. The second year we came in, they lined us all up on a wall, sat us in chairs, and they proceeded to do this mock therapy session because of the fact one of the local parole officers aspires to be a therapist. So she's using the parole office to practice her, get her hours in for her psychology. You know, they have to put in X amount of hours to get their license to practice. So she's using that forum to practice on us.
That is your opinion. So let's be careful.
That is my opinion. Yes.
Okay.
Well, and I wouldn't be concerned, except I believe that if she ever did get in that position, it would be a very heavy-handed, oppressive type of therapy through the parole department. Because first and foremost, she is a parole office.
I have no doubt. What about this year? They had you sign a contract.
This
this year, and yes. It applied to people who had jobs. What did they tell the people that had jobs?
Yes. Well, we were all made to sign contracts several weeks back that we would drive over to this city and agree to lock down for 5 hours.
And you had to take off work, right? If you were working.
Start making preparations with your employer so that you could be at this lockdown. So this year, I made preparations. I drove over there earlier today, and at about 2 o'clock, I received a phone call, or my ankle bracelet started going off from my parole officer. I called him back, and he said, "Oh, you guys don't have to show up anymore." Well, I've already driven 90 miles over there, so then I had to turn around and drive 90 miles back. Which I'm okay with that, because I really wasn't looking forward to sitting in there 5 hours and doing this pretend therapy thing that this particular officer is practicing. So it was pretty much a wasted day off of work. The costs of fuel and travel time and money lost from work to drive over there and come back. So I can only assume or guess that something happened from Narsal or you all to impact that decision this afternoon on the parole department.
Well, we don't want to take credit, but we've been trying to change people's minds, and it's possible that that we had an impact on them, but it's very troubling to me that your support for your family is being undermined by having to report and take off work to go sit in a place where there's a non-existent problem.
Yes,
exactly. This is happening in Suffolk County, New York, of all places. I mean, this is. But I just wanted to get you in there. We tried to get you on last year, and you were not able to because they had you confined. We appreciate you updating us. If anybody has any ramifications from losing their job or anything, let us know. You know how to contact us.
Okay. Well, and you know, the funny thing is that everyone in that room has an ankle bracelet, a real-time ankle bracelet. So I don't understand what the point of us all going over there and sitting in a room is when they know where we're at.
Yep. So, well, thank you. Thank you, sir.
I'd be more than happy to keep you. You're welcome. You're welcome, and thank you.
So, all right. We've got... Mr. Connecticut, we're going to get to you. We're going to take a couple of questions. We're going to do the case that we had scheduled here, but we're going to get you in here. So just bear with us. I see you, and we're going to get to you. King, we're going to talk about internet restrictions and blanket restrictions and the case that you and I have talked about that came out of the Third Circuit. What can we concisely say that we've learned from that case of U.S. versus Holina, or Holina, or however he pronounced it, however they pronounce that? What it looks like to me that's a very good, very well reasoned decision. What say you?
Yes, and his first name is Brandon, so I'm suspecting they probably pronounce it Holina instead of Olena. And for those who don't know, the Federal Third Circuit Court of Appeals has appellate jurisdiction over all the U.S. District Courts in Delaware, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania. Actually, there's only one district in each of Delaware and New Jersey, and three Eastern, Middle, and Western in Pennsylvania, same as Louisiana. It's a very good case, and I just want to comment about the gentleman from New Mexico. Just wow. It never ceases to amaze me the impositions that inventive minds can come up with. And I'm just wondering if there's any statutory law requiring that. And this business about being required to sign a contract. I had one client, and they do that here in my part of Louisiana, require people to sign contracts. And when I challenge in court that, well, Your Honor, they can't put their finger on any statutory law that says that they have to do this or that they can't do this and so. And they say, well, he signed a contract. Well, you know, I remember studying contracts at law school, and there is something called vices of consent. And one of those is duress. I had a client who was smart enough to actually sign his contract and write under duress, you know, and he didn't have any particular consequences because he's a guy who doesn't cause problems. But I mean, it's ridiculous. And that is a lawsuit waiting to happen, because even if you didn't lose money from work, you're losing money. It's costing you money. So that is a deprivation of property without due process of law. It's a 1983 action. If somebody wanted to bring it, if they're going to stop doing it, maybe there's a little point, but there it is. Okay. Well, about Helena, this is right off the presses. It they filed it.
Your time's up.
Okay, we're going to a break now. Start the music.
All right, just kidding. So
October 10th, 2018. And it is a really great example of that no matter, you know, what someone's offense was and how severe the restrictions that he can be put under, there still is something called due process, and there are rules. In the Third Circuit, I have to hand it to them, really just approached this dispassionately and laid out what their rules are and followed them, and they found the treatment in the court below deficient. And what Mr. Helena had been convicted of doing, it was one of these, and we had the fellow who was going to maybe hang on for me talking about internet entrapment. This was one of those. The man had repeatedly had visited online chat room and tried to entice a 14-year-old boy to meet him and have sex.
But it was actually the police. He, but go ahead.
Well, I would just except for the little technicality that the 14-year-old boy was actually a full-grown FBI agent. So there really was no minor involved. When he arrived at the meeting spot, which was at a park, he was arrested and so on. And he did 10 years and received a lifetime of supervised release. So he was under supervision. When I took a question from someone earlier, it changed the picture for us a little bit that the fellow was under supervision. But this assumed the worst of everything. This person was under supervision. And not only had he done the crime and known it was wrong and did it on purpose anyway. Why did my screen just go black? It doesn't matter. Okay, I'll revive it. But he had already violated his supervision twice. The first time he went online to update social media profiles and answer emails. The second time he logged into Facebook without approval. I mean, he was allowed some computer use, but he was always supposed to get permission from his probation officer, which is, I guess they still call them probation officers. Parole is abolished in the federal system, but supervised release is what they call that now. And so each time he was punished. I mean, the first time they gave him an extra 9 months and added conditions, and then he violated it again the time he went on Facebook without approval, and he got another extra 9 months imprisonment, and they reimposed other special conditions. But the second time, what the judge did is what the subject of the case is. The judge imposed another condition forbidding him to possess or use any computers, electronic communications devices, or electronic storage devices. And he objected to this lifetime ban from those things and took it up. And good for him, because he won. And the court lays out their standard of reviews, and it's not a very high burden that the district court had to meet, but yet they failed to meet it because he won his case. They had to have, quote, some evidence that the special conditions imposed were, quote, tangibly related, unquote, to the goals of supervised release. And there had to be some supporting facts. They had to be able, they could affirm, the Court of Appeals could affirm if they could, quote, ascertain any viable basis, unquote, in the record for the restriction. And here they just concluded that they could not. It was a lack of tailoring, because he was banned from computers and from internet use. And the restrictions were contradictory because on the one hand, he's banned from using any device. And on the other hand, he was supposed to have approval from the probation officer before accessing the internet. Well, I don't know how you access the internet without a digital device, but this is what the Court of Appeals found contradictory. So they found that these requirements conflicts and in conflict with each other, and that was a problem for the Court of Appeals. Basically, they found those restrictions more restrictive than necessary, and they laid out their rules, and they said that internet ban. They cited also Packingham for some of their propositions, which weren't originally cited in the court below, but they had solicited amicus briefs that brought it in. Interesting quote on page 7 of the slip opinion, internet bans. Well, they said that first that internet bans and restrictions have a role in protecting the public from sexual predators. But then they said, still, internet bans are draconian. And we have said this as much, even in cases where we have upheld them. And they consider three factors. The restrictions length, its coverage, and the defendant's underlying conduct. And they worked their way through each of those. And then they had a fourth factor, which was the proportion of the supervised release restriction to the total restriction period. Well, since for this man it was a lifetime ban, they said we give that fourth factor no weight at all. So about the length, they started right out saying we're troubled that these restrictions will last as long as he does. So they just have a problem with lifetime bans, anything. It just doesn't seem reasonably related. And particularly when you consider what some of what we heard from Ms. Bellucci earlier, that people wean themselves off that conduct with age, you know. And as she said, after 15 years, you know, just don't have the recidivism. And they said they had never upheld a lifetime ban in a precedential opinion. I wish the Fifth Circuit was this progressive. They aren't. That's the South for you. But they did say, it's a really interesting quote on page 8 of the opinion. They're quoting from actually Packingham. We're conscious that the forces and directions of the internet are so new, so protean, and so far-reaching that any restrictions imposed today might be obsolete tomorrow. And then the scope. And the computer and the internet bans both sweep too broadly. Because this is interesting. He was banned from computers and digital devices, even if they were not connected to the internet.
That's what I was going to zero in on, because people are getting a little giddy out there. They're listening that you can't ban people or restrict them. The way I read this, and you can feel free to disagree, I read this that... you possibly can do a ban, but you probably should have given him a finite amount of time, less than life, and you probably ought to have tailored it a little bit to give him access to devices and to some internet. It didn't say that no ban is permissible. They said a blanket, outright lifetime ban is unreasonable, but there's scant evidence to support that.
Exactly. And they said what they're saying, it's overbroad. It's too restrictive. It's not tailored. If it bans him from sites where he's not likely to encounter a child, they say specifically on page 9 of the opinion. Just getting ahead of myself a little bit, that they say the limitations against using any devices prevent him from doing everyday tasks, like preparing a resume or calling a friend for a ride. And none of these activities puts the public at risk. So it's just not reasonably related. It's a rational basis test there. It's just not reasonably related to any permissible goals. There is a permissible goal to prevent this man from being able to contact underage partners or potential partners to cultivate them. But every use of a device doesn't present that risk, and so they were over-banning. And then they go on to the internet ban, the bottom of page 9. The internet ban fares a little better. It prevents him from accessing anything on the internet. And then on the following page 10, they talk about he'll probably never encounter a child. Places like Google Maps or Amazon and dictionary.com or the court's own website. They said he can, if he can't interact with others or view explicit materials, then there's no justification for that extent of the ban. And the converse is true. If he would be able to interact with others or view explicit materials, they do have a basis for restricting him, which goes to what Larry was saying. His conduct is the third fact. They said, and they point out, he did the worst things. He used the internet to solicit sex from a full-grown FBI agent, whom I would call officer pretending, you know, pretending to be a minor. But they kind of gloss over that. They just say he used the internet to solicit sex from a minor, which he didn't really do, but they say he thought that's what he was doing, and that he knew it was wrong, and he did it anyway. Okay, and he repeatedly violated the terms of a supervised release. But as to whether they tailored the special conditions to protect the public from similar crimes, it was just inadequate. The tailoring is still required, no longer, you know, no matter, you know, how bad the thing was that he had originally done and how many times he's messed up on supervision. And they recognize this as a case where the need to protect the public is strongest. And when the defendant used the internet to molest children, I object to the term molest there, because the fake child in question apparently was perfectly willing. So that would be more in the nature of an indecent behavior rather than a molestation, which implies a battery, which means not even an invalid underage consent being involved.
Well, King, let's go to the back to the analog days. Let's just say that you figured out a way to commit criminality, and you stole the utilities, telephone, or whatever it was. Would they be able? And let's choose a utility. Forget that we have the internet. Put us back 35, 40 years where it was all telephone. If you were a telephone abuser, would they have been able to refuse you to have access to any telecommunications, or would they have been able to limited your access so that you could not abuse the telephone? And I know some people that have had that problem in their life. Well, that if you learn how to steal electricity, would we be able to tell you can't have any electrical service because you might steal from the electric company? Or would we be able to say that we're going to be able to monitor your electricity usage very carefully and to see if you have any illegal hookups? I think it's pretty obvious.
Bingo, right. Monitoring is less restrictive. And things like being able to use the telephone is so important for daily life these days. And speech, you know, and I made a notation in the margin that's similar to your line of thought. It's like saying you can't use any metal tools, stone only. You know, like if you had used a knife to stab somebody, then they say, okay, no more metal tools for you, stone only for you. Because that they're putting you back in the Stone Age, so to speak, if they're saying you can't use any kind of digital device at all, even if it's not connected to the internet, or saying that you can't use the internet at all, even to visit sites where you're not going to interact with people or view explicit materials. It's just overreach.
Okay, well, and here's the question that everybody's out there asking. There's still almost 100 people here. Well, how come we've got all these decisions coming down from Packingham and all over from West Virginia? And how come it is, even though all this favorable jurisprudence, how come they keep doing it? How come they don't stop?
They don't want to stop, and part of it is they're afraid to stop. They feel like they'll have political or civil liability if they take a chance on people, and they don't have any faith in the people that they supervise not to mess up again. Just the safest thing for them is to be as draconian as possible. Now, that's not necessarily a permanent condition. The solution is to make it less safe for them to err on the side of restriction and draconian imposition. And the way to make it less safe for them is to sue them and to sue the state for which they work and to collect the judgments and the attorney's fees.
Well, that's easier for you to say. Well, these people oftentimes are on minimum wage. They're on $12 an hour. And, oh, how are we going to find a lawyer? When I go talk to a lawyer about a sex offense issue, they slammed the door shut in my face and they said, I don't want to see you. How do we bring litigation on this stuff? Because that's also what people want to ask me and say, how come you don't understand, Larry, that we don't have the ability to litigate?
Well, and that's where NARSOL really is the angel in this. NARSOL has for a long time assisted impact litigation for expenses like court reporters and experts, but just recently, and to a limited extent, has crossed an important line to say that, you know, our donors want suits to be brought. And so NARSOL's board has allowed it to actually help seed some attorney's fees. And so I'm trying to help with the case to get that started in Louisiana. My own work prevents me from being too actively involved in it, but I've got an award-winning attorney who's ready to go, and we're trying to marshal the facts to get one started. And it's also very helpful that there is this federal law called 1983 action. It's 42 United States Code, section 1983, and it allows for statutory attorney's fees. There must be state action, and there must be a deprivation of liberty or property, but that's what you have in these cases. And so some plaintiffs are able to bring a little bit of assets, and every bit helps. NARSOL can't afford to finance every aspect of these litigations. And the other thing that they've done is to find attorneys who are willing to go out on a limb and take some financial risk of their time, and which is, you know, lost opportunity costs if they could be spending their time making money. But there are a lot of people who went into law to make the world better and not just to just to load up sacks of money. So they prove very talented at finding those attorneys, and there are litigations going on around the country, and the effort is always being made to start more where it's needed, to find the need and where the impact will be the greatest for the greatest number of people.
So, well, Robin, go ahead, because we're about to draw a prize contest.
I just wanted to interject.
Yes, sir.
In answer to your question, why does this keep happening? I think there's a generational aspect to this that oftentimes gets overlooked. That's that the people that are putting these laws into place oftentimes are just not familiar enough with the technologies. So they can't, you know, they can't really comprehend fully what it means to deprive somebody of what we would consider, most of us at a certain age anyway, would consider to be so ubiquitous as to be absolutely essential, much like the phone is at this point.
These people, when it's laws, but oftentimes we're dealing with just policies that where there is no law underlying them. Andy was told when he contacted about moving to another state, they said, you better stay where you are, because we don't let anybody on sex offender supervision have any access to the internet. And fortunately, this decision covers that particular state.
It does, and Packingham is a breakthrough, because you have a majority of the court. Now, one of that five-member, they all voted that for the decision. It was unanimous as far as that goes. But five of them, which is one of those five, is no longer on the court, because that's the one who just retired, replaced by Kavanaugh. But five of them said that the internet is the public square of today. And then the four conservatives said, whoa, they didn't really need to go that far, but they still voted, you know. Yeah,
well, they voted in a concurring opinion, but they were worried about that runaway dicta. We're going to draw
a prize. But it's true, but we have cases where it really is the public square and really is the public street that can be brought. So we have all nine justices for that, but we have four or five, don't really know right now, because I say one of the five has retired. But Packingham is a breakthrough. Why didn't it immediately change the conduct of every state? Because of what I said before, they're erring on the side. My motto is err only on the side of liberty. Well, the motto of people who supervise sex offenders or registered humans, as I prefer to say, they err on the side of not liberty. They err on the side of restriction and imposition, and prohibition and coercion.
They also know what an uphill battle you have trying to find representation and going to court. And in the meantime, they're trying to violate you while you're doing all that. But we're going to draw the prize for the final giveaway for tonight. Andy, have you got ready to roll the drums?
Oh, and one second. And of course, somebody wants to enter into the contest like right now.
Okay, well, go ahead. Let them roll the drums. But the contest lines are closed. We've been promoting it for the entire program. So if you can capture that one and then put it in the drawing, we'll do it. And this is for a $100 gift card. And we haven't designated what the gift card's going to be. It's going to be up to you. Hopefully, you will not choose one that has an activation fee because that adds to the $100, which we may subtract out. but if you pick a $100 for a department store or something that we can get, we will get that to you. And so you can spend it at the NARSL conference. Now, what would be? Do we have a rule about if the same person were to be drawn again, or are they out of the contest?
I pull them out.
Okay. So,
So this person has the code of 899.
Contestant number 899. Are you listening to us right now?
Last four digits of 9721.
9721 and area code?
I just sent it to you.
Yeah. Okay. 720. That would be Colorado, I do believe. If I recollect my area codes, and I know many of them.
You do know a lot of them. It's a little creepy.
I'm a telephone junkie. I'm the person I know that has that issue.
I used to. A long time ago, I used to know the area codes like that.
And what did you do that caused you to have so much knowledge about telephone area codes?
Old computer bulletin board systems.
If you go to 720, if you're listening, we need to see you in the queue, or you need to text Andy. It's the same number that you're here, because otherwise we're going to draw another person. You have to be listening to win the 100. And I'm going through quickly trying to see. So I need you to hit *6 and jump in the queue. Or I need you to text Andy and say prize. And if you don't do that, we're going to roll the drums and we're going to pick someone else. I remember last year when we did this, there was a person trying. And they said, I'm trying to text you people. I'm trying to call it, get in the queue, and nothing's working. So I don't see them anywhere on the board. I've scrolled through every person. Well, that's unfortunate.
I got it. I got it.
You got it? Okay. So they are listening. They are listening. Well, congratulations. I don't know why I can't see them on the board.
They are texting me and giving me names and phone numbers and all this stuff. So I got it.
So, all right.
I've got a text from them.
They would not be able to text you if they weren't listening.
That is very true. They would not know.
All righty. Well, then we have our winner, and we're going to finish with, King. We're going to try to cover another topic, kind of a topic, cause we've got a Connecticut attorney on here that wants to talk about an issue. So we want to close out, take a couple of calls that are in the queue about this, and then we want to talk about a cert petition to the United States Supreme Court, which I think you've reviewed, and we've reviewed it. And so we want to cover that. So we're going to bring you in just very shortly. But let me do these calls about internet restrictions. There's one of them dropped, so there's only one here, so maybe this won't take a long time. And then area code 850, you're on Halloween Marathon with King Alexander.
Hey. Yeah, good evening, Mr. Alexander. Again, Joseph Pratt here in Florida on probation. I got caught up on an internet sexting. Going to a website looking for a consenting adult woman, and you know they were spinning a sting operation for people to look for minors. I got blessed in court in oral pronouncement where I do not have an internet restriction, so I got blessed in that situation. But
right.
But I I read somewhere in the NARSL website a few months ago where you were challenging something in the Louisiana Supreme Court in regards to internet entrapment. And that's so I've read that, you know?
Yes. It's hard for me to know which one it was, and not having seen it on the NARSL website, but I was involved in that. In fact, they actually changed the law in Louisiana because of a memorandum that I did that went viral around Louisiana and was made part of an argument at that level. But unfortunately, the attorney did it by supplemental memorandum, and so the Supreme Court, and I was there because I was on the amicus, saw an opportunity not to reach the issue. They said, well, you have to, he should have amended the actual motion instead of just doing a supplemental memorandum. So it's not before the court, but they knew they had to fix it because the next time that we came at them on it, it would have been done properly. And it was a First Amendment challenge. I see the internet sting. I don't see nearly as many solicitation, computer-aided solicitation cases as I used to. I think it was kind of a fad at the time, and the first wave of people who were caught in it didn't even really know about the law against it. And of course, that's never a defense. Yeah. And I think they used to think that people who did that were particularly dangerous. And I'm not seeing as many. I'm sure it still happens, but everything I handle is a life without parole case. So I don't know. But I'm not hearing as much about them, that's for sure. As far as the entrapment aspect of it, I think we did talk before about, you know, it's a tough burden to show an actual entrapment because you have to show that you didn't have the proclivity or the inclination. And they set the hook and reel you in again, more or less against your will.
I've
assisted on defenses on that, but you go ahead and make your point.
True, but at the same time, if you're looking for an adult, you're looking for an adult, and if the police spin something in a different direction, you know, it's unfair that they do so.
It is, and let me say the one that.
So continue.
Yeah, and you were only interested in adults, and they managed to trap you and get you involved, and then the person says, and I tried exactly this case. The man was in a Yahoo chat room that you were supposed to be 18 years old to enter. And it was easily defeated by the state trooper in that case because we're in the place where you're supposed to enter your age. If you entered a number that was under 18, it wouldn't let you in. Well, they found that they could get in by entering no number at all. And so this man encountered an officer pretending who is a state trooper and engages the man in conversation. And then later says, well, I'm only so old. And he responds, well, it's not how old you are, it's how you feel about the person. And they went from there, you know. So the jury didn't have a lot of sympathy with that. And there wasn't really, I thought it was dirty pool that it was in an adults only chat room and that they affirmatively defeated Yahoo's efforts to screen out younger people. They managed to get enough conversation back and forth with him that it seemed like he was perfectly willing to go after someone younger.
That's what I was going to say, Keith. I've helped on defenses, and that's exactly what happens. The entrapee, if they show no inclination whatsoever, if they said, you go to hell and get off of this, I'm going to report you, but they never do because they're not talking to a minor. They're talking to a very, very skilled, very competent, that understands psychology, and they reel these people in to their web.
You mean a dirty cop?
Yes,
right.
They're able to meet the predisposed component of entrapment because it's not entrapment if you are predisposed to commit a crime and you happen to approach a cop. People go to all these trouble. They say, "Are you a cop?" When they're thinking about hiring a hooker, it doesn't make any difference. The cop says no. Makes absolutely no difference because the cop can lie.
Anything.
But this particular fellow completely resisted every effort to get him to travel for a meeting. But there was webcam activity. I found that all the cases are either travel cases or the webcam activity cases. But the Louisiana statute didn't even prohibit the webcam activity. It was only about textual communications. But the jury found enough there, and it was one of these Louisiana non-unanimous juries. I think that was an 11-1 verdict or 10-2 verdict. So maybe it would have been a hung jury if we had unanimous verdict then.
So,
as someone who has inordinate experience with this particular subject matter, having been convicted of it, I think one of the reasons you don't see as much of it anymore is the demise of the chat room. It's not as easy for them to do what they were doing. What has always bothered me most about these cases is that the corpus delicti, the actual, body of evidence, especially if there are no anything else, is a product of a cooperative effort. So you have the cop really with dirty hands, who has helped to create at least 50% of the evidence. That is then used to convict an American citizen. And that, to me, is really what's most immoral about it.
And I think that more people are disapproving of it.
There's no victim.
And as the comments that I see to articles online is a lot of people pushing back on this behavior of sheriffs on Halloween and toward registered people generally. So I think the tide of public opinion is turning somewhat.
So... I hope that helps, but like I said, I've helped on defense teams and we get nowhere. We've tried that defense in liberal jurisdictions. We tried it in conservative jurisdiction. We get nowhere. It doesn't make any difference. I'd like to think that there's some jurisdiction that would be like, if you try a drug possession case in Boulder, Colorado, you're going to get no conviction. The jury there is going to laugh at you. But no matter where we've tried these cases in my state, the juries don't want to hear about that. Once you indicate any proclivity towards a minor, once they've announced that they're a minor and you didn't say go to hell and I'm reporting you, that's all the jury seems to need to hear.
Yeah.
So.
So it doesn't matter how many negative responses you give to the police. And they continue to tempt you. I got you.
Yeah. You've got to disengage and say, I'm reporting you to the police for being in an underage chat room because you don't belong here. It's tantalizing because what they're doing, they're using their skills to make you think that they're an especially mature minor, and you are. It piques your interest because they didn't make them like that when I was that age, and that's what goes through the average person's mind: is this person is really mature. Right, well, of course they are, because they're 39 years old. They're not 14 or 15. I hope that helps.
It was ridiculous. Even when the guy said, "Do you have an older sister?" Then he gets the jealousy routine from the cop.
Well, if anybody else wants to get in the queue for later, we're going to go to I hope I can get his name right. We haven't done any prep on this, but we've got James Cornelio from Connecticut, who is, I believe, a practicing attorney. James, did I pronounce that anywhere near? Did I pronounce that anywhere near close?
Very on the mark, James Cornelio.
Okay, James has been dealing with an issue in his state related to when re-verification, the frequency of which can vary. In his case, it's 4 times a year. The Connecticut Central Registry sends out a paper form, and it needs to be returned within 10 days. And then if the form is not returned within 10 days, there is a notification to local law enforcement that the person has not complied, and the statute says seek a warrant for these people. And James, you have been fighting this for when your district court case started, but it's been for how many years?
Actually, that particular issue was only raised at the Supreme Court level. If when you read the petition, you'd see that I made why I thought they should hear it nonetheless. So their denial of cert did not in any way, to my understanding, affect the possibility of bringing up the case again, because there was no lower court decisions on that particular issue. And it seems, I know you guys, you know, I'm new to NARSOL, but I'm sure that this has been an issue, ex post facto questions. You probably have been all over them, have dissected them, have analyzed them, have thought about them. But I'm wondering if, given the nature of the way this particular statute is written, and I got to believe other statutes in other states are similarly written, it would be, because it is in fact punitive. Because if you go back to Smith v. Doe, they had a very particular type of statute in front of them. It was a statute which had no mandates in it. In fact, the Supreme Court judge who wrote the opinion specifically said, we can look at the intent of the legislators by noting that they have no mandates in that statute. Because in their analysis, and I'm getting, I guess, a little bit technical here, but in their analysis, there were two ways of analyzing it. If, in fact, it was deemed regulatory rather than punitive, it did not violate ex post facto laws. So their whole analysis was, what was the intent of the legislators? Was it intended to be regulatory rather than punitive? And even if it were intended to be regulatory, does it, under a case called Smith v. Mendoza or Kennedy, I forget the name offhand, does it, you know, there were standards in there that would say, well, even if their intent was for it to be not punitive, does it satisfy these particular conditions, which would in fact show it's not punitive? So I'm arguing that the statute that the Supreme Court approved as being non-punitive is very different from the statute that Connecticut has. As you noted, the statute essentially says, if you are one day late, the sex offender police in Middletown must refer the case to local police, and local police must seek a warrant, and you are strictly liable. And the highest court in the state of Connecticut confirmed that. So basically, you are liable for late mail. That's absolutely nothing to do with whether or not you continue to live in your home. And I remember you saying before, when I was listening, that something about they have to prove that you moved. Well, not in Connecticut. All they have to prove is that you were one day late in mailing it. Now, if you're going to argue to me that that's regulatory with a purpose to actually confirm the residence of sex offenders, which is the purpose of the law, rather than going around and beating them up, I would say that's not a particularly rational position for you to take. So, I think that
James, hang on just a second. I want to take an issue back at you. We're talking about two different things. You're getting held strictly liable for not returning the form. That's a separate crime from not being at the residence where they're, when they put in the criminal complaint that you're no longer residing at 1234 Anywhere Lane, Albuquerque, New Mexico. They need to be able to prove that you're no longer there. Connecticut can define
that's another part of the law. They have another part of the statute which says if in fact you move without informing them, then you are liable under another part of the law.
Why can't Connecticut, when you don't return the form on time, why can that not be a crime? Failure to return the form. What makes that?
Well, my argument is that that was approved by the Supreme Court, the obligation to continue to confirm your residence was approved by the Supreme Court as not being punitive on the basis of a particular statute that is very different from the mandates in the Connecticut statute. And in fact, the Supreme Court specifically noted the lack of mandates in saying that, well, clearly the Alaska legislators did not intend a punitive statute. Because of the lack of mandates. Connecticut did not only ignored the Supreme Court preference for lack of mandates, they put in three very potent mandates. The obligation to send the late mail notice to the local police, the obligation of the local police to then seek a warrant, and the fact that you are strictly liable for that should you in fact be a day late. And they don't even enforce it that way, because to enforce it that way, because people are, what happens if you're out of town or you're sick or you're attending to someone who's sick? They have to somehow or another make accommodations for that. And they do, even though they're given zero authority to do anything other than what the statute says.
King, so the statute says you shall seek a warrant. If they choose not to seek a warrant because they've made provisions for the late return, is there anything inherently wrong with that from a constitutional perspective?
What I understand part of what he's complaining about is that the law mandates a certain thing to be done that's more draconian than what they're actually doing. They're actually ignoring the law and making it a little bit looser.
That's a separate issue. I've dropped that issue because I've understood that's a loser. That's a loser.
Okay.
What I'm arguing now is that there are reasonable ways to confirm residency. And in fact, someone from Illinois was on and they said, well, the cop drives by and confirms that I live there. Bingo, no problem. What we have here, though, is something that has absolutely nothing to do with what its purpose is, which is the confirmation of your residence. It has to do with late mail. And there's a multitude of other more reasonable alternatives. And that's the Mendoza case, which says, is this rational and is it excessive? If it's either of those two things, then you can make the argument that is, in fact, punitive.
Well, you're talking about Kennedy versus Mendoza Martinez, the 1963 case.
Exactly.
And the intent effects test. And just for those listening, it's one thing if you can find in the text of the law itself or in its legislative history if there was a punitive intent. And one of the cases that struck down a registration schemes or parts of registration schemes in Kansas and one of the Great Plains states, they actually found it in the legislative history. Maybe I'm thinking about Starkey out of Oklahoma, which is a state court case, but they actually found in legislative history that we're passing this because we hate child molesters and we want to make things as hard for them as we possibly can. Well, that is punitive intent. And so they were able to skip all that difficult proof of proving that it was punitive in fact. When you don't have, and now I can tell you that the Louisiana scheme, they've got a lot of self-serving language in the opening section of its registration law that's similar to what you're talking about that says we're only doing this because there's this compelling interest of the state and you have to have your own state scheme and you have to make it retroactive. So they're afraid of not being able to get that money. They got shot down quite a bit on that in the acting deputy solicitor general's amicus that was solicited by the court in Snyder versus Doe, which was the cert application of the state of Michigan in the Doe's versus Snyder out of the Sixth Circuit. And so they denied cert. And so that stood. But the federal solicitor general said, we don't require them to have these extra punitive things that they've put into their law. And they're not going to lose the federal funding if they don't do that. So that undermined them to a great extent. Having to prove the punitive effect, I think, is the key. And you may be on, if you've got a good issue here, that is probably it. Now, strict liability is a due process issue, and we've also seen that in some of the cases that were successful. I'm reminded of the Mennonite case with this thing of putting a letter into the mail that at least you could do is before you take someone's property is put a letter in the mail to their last known address. But this is not just that. They're putting the letter in the mail to last known address, and in Mennonite, it's like, well, that's all the notice they have to give you before they seize your property. But this is making criminal effects of not getting the mail. New felonies. Yeah.
Right. A Class D felony for late mail. That's my point. And my other point is that there's like the Illinois guy said, there are easy and rational ways to redo this law. I'm not saying I'm trying to get rid of the law. I understand I got to register. I'm just saying that this law is so ridiculously punitive, it should be rewritten. And there are rational ways to do it. One of them would be like they do in Illinois, where a cop stops by every once in a while and says, oh, yeah, you still live there. Another would be to have a presumption standard rather than a strict liability standard. So they send out the three letters that they've been doing as a matter of a protocol, not as a matter of them having any rights under the law to do that, but as a matter of a protocol that they've just implemented unilaterally. And they send those three letters out, and if you don't sign and return one of those, then they have the right to presume you have moved. But this isn't that. This is you're one day late after 10 days, and you are deemed guilty of a Class D felony, when the purpose of the law is to confirm residence, not to confirm whether or not you can mail your mail in on time. It just seems to me so over the top that that this is something that should be challenged. And I got to believe if Connecticut has something like this, lots of other states do too.
I commend you for challenging it. I think these efforts have to be made. I can't venture opinion on what I think the chances are of your application being granted, because you know the odds on that. It's very rare, and they have to see a significant federal right being impaired, and it helps if there's a split between the highest courts of states or a split between federal circuits. That tremendously increases your odds of getting certiorari granted. But I'm glad that you're making the effort, because I think that there's much more reasonable ways that they could determine, you've already pointed out, where you live, which is the issue. And they're trying to set a trap for you. And I think in the case out of Kansas, there was quite a bit. There are due process implications, you know, for strict liability, in-person reporting, just a great many impositions. Doe versus Nebraska is Doe
okay,
versus
because,
Nebraska.
I mean, one of the questions I have, my understanding is the only time they ever really reviewed a confirmation dress verification requirement was in this, the original case, Smith v. Doe. And that address verification requirement, as I say, is bare bones. And they virtually commended the legislators for saying, well, let the police figure out how best to confirm residency. And, of course, that was also a misdemeanor. So I don't know. My resources are limited. I don't have access to LexisNexis. So, you know, and this, like I say, was only brought up at the Supreme Court level. So there was never any argument at any point. In fact, the state's attorney general, for other reasons, I think, decided not even to respond to my petition for cert. So I don't even know what argument they would have made. So I guess partly what I'm wondering is whether, given your much greater familiarity with these laws, if in fact you've ever heard of something like this that has been approved where there would be a quote-unquote split among the circuits. My guess is not, because it's simply never been challenged in the way I'm proposing to challenge it.
Bingo. There are so few challenges. And I don't know, I really haven't had enough time with this to know what the procedural issues may be that would result in them denying certiorari. But lots of times I think that you're not going to get relief until you get there. And so we have to keep hammering. And that's what we've done with non-unanimous jury in Louisiana, is doing cert application after cert application. And we haven't had one take hold yet, and so to the point that the political process has overtaken the judicial process, and we're getting relief, at least prospectively, by changing the state constitution. But we're still going to keep attacking with cert applications on the rest, and I think it helps that we've had a political change in the meantime, so it's a narrow window instead of the whole perspective.
Jim, I want to make two points here. Cert petitions, it is not uncommon that the state doesn't respond, because there's only one in 100 chances or so, or 1,000 chances. They get 9,000, they grant 90. So they decline to respond unless the court requests a response. So there's nothing unusual about that. That is exactly what they do at almost
right.
They don't.
That's true.
But in terms of your, I'm just curious, have you done any research? Because there's only a handful of states that have a mail-in protocol. And most people around the country are required to report to sheriff's office and be fingerprinted and booked and humiliated and wait in line and take a day off work. And they have to go
and harassed.
Enormous hoops. And in some cases, they're put in jail uniforms. So Janice Bellucci had to litigate against that for being jailed. And they would die for the opportunity to have a mail-in form that they don't have to actually go in person and go through all this humiliation. So just make sure, as you're thinking about this, to think about it in the context of the broader registry schemes. You're in a state where this is just a very rare anomaly where they do it this way.
Yeah, what else could they do?
That's exactly why I was calling the national organization. Because I have no idea. And I don't know whether their ability to go through, whether it's been challenged. Can you humiliate registrants just while they're confirming their residency by, I don't know whether there's been other challenges to other means of overacting for something as simple as confirming residency.
there is. They go out with Gestapo units with several officers, and they put big red flyers on their door, and they tell them to call in, and they do all sorts of humiliating things. Like I say, in the comparative things, you in Connecticut and people in Vermont and the states where they just get a form that they can mail in, that's a small number of states where that is allowed. And the fact that they're are not arresting everybody that doesn't get them in on time. I mean, it seems like to me that's what we want people to do. It's not prosecute everybody can give them
the circumstances. Okay, because in Louisiana, it's in-person reporting. It's within 3 business days. And if you and this isn't even part of the law. You show up within the 3 days, and they say, you can't just show up like that. Without, you have to call and make an appointment. And then so they give you your appointment date, and it's beyond the end of the time, and you come in, and they arrest you for failure to register because you're not within the time. I mean, it's just ridiculous. But what interests me about your situation, you're saying that it's strict liability, and then you're presumed guilty of a new felony because you didn't get your mail. I mean, that seems crazy. I may say, well, if you know you're going to be traveling, you can handle someone to take care of your mail or whatever. But I see real notice, reasonableness, notice problems.
On your behalf, and
you have to do it. So so it interferes with your building.
Whether there are states that are similar where people feel equally kind of questioning as to whether or not there's a better way. I haven't been involved with NARSL, but when I heard the guy talking about what happens in Illinois, and California has no confirmation. Is that correct?
I don't know the answer to that, even though I passed the California bar. I'm not up on that, you know.
Jim, the part you're missing about Illinois, the Jim part you're missing, is these are verifications on top of what's required in person. These are verifications where law enforcement takes it upon themselves to go door to door and put these flyers on the doors, and they're in many jurisdictions, they're done to humiliate. And it sounds like his agency is being kind about it because their command structure is telling them to do this. But we're talking about extra verifications that are not required by statute. We're talking about these door-to-door verifications. Mm-hmm.
Those have been challenged and failed? People have gone into court and said, look what they did just to confirm my residency, and the court said, well, that's okay.
They
you say Gestapo tactics. You would think at some point you go into a federal district court and you show Gestapo tactics for something as simple as confirming residency, and they would stop at least that. Because again, I'm not questioning the right to the information. I'm just saying, how can you do it in a way that is quote unquote non-punitive and regulatory, which is what the Supreme Court required.
Well, we agree with you on that. The Gestapo tactics are over the top, but we're always constrained on litigation because there's too many agencies doing things that they shouldn't be doing, and not enough funding and not enough attorneys to go after.
Relatively few of these schemes. Yeah. Relatively few of these schemes have been challenged.
It could be a lot worse. I'm not going to challenge this because it could be worse. Yes, it could be worse. But, you know, unless you start, and I think that there are other more important things that we should be doing rather than litigating. But since litigation is one of the avenues that we can pursue, to me, it just seemed like, given the fact that there is a Supreme Court case out there that says these must be regulatory and non-punitive, and when you can show reasonable regulatory ways of doing it, like the presumption standard, like, somebody stopping by, if they want to stop by with tanks and guns and whatnot, then you challenge them stopping by with tanks and guns and whatnot. But it seems to me, at least then, that you're doing what the statute is intended to do, which is confirming residency, as opposed to confirming that you don't send your mail in late.
We're going to take a couple calls and we're going to end this because I know King's ready to go to bed. But I mean, we support yeah. you. It's just that we are dubious with the courts the way they are that you're going to get traction. But anytime anybody's challenging a component of registration, it's a good thing. So
I wish you luck and cheer you on. And Smith versus Doe really isn't precedent for much anymore because the Alaska scheme was not nearly what it became later. And 4 years later, the Supreme Court of Alaska invalidated it themselves on constitutional grounds, including ex post facto.
Jim, I'm leaving you live so that you can respond, because I think this might be somebody wanted to respond to what you've said. So you could, you're still here, right? Jim?
Can you hear me?
Yes, but I'm making sure Jim is still here. Yeah, Jim Cornelia, you're still here, right?
My name is Greg.
We may have lost it. Yeah, I brought you in, but I want just a moment. I brought you in, but I wanted you to. I think you were going to respond to what Jim was saying, so I was going to bring you two together. So go ahead with your question. It seems like we've lost Jim.
Well, my question was: I was at work a couple of days ago, and I got a call from my neighbor saying that the sheriff's department was or some law enforcement agency was at my house, showing my picture to everybody, and then they aired this live on TV. And I'm off parole. I don't understand the deal with it, and I think it's wrong. I'm not trying to get beat up or shot, kicked out of my neighborhood. I don't know if there's any grounds for me, but I guess Janice, I brought it to Janice Bellucci's attention. She posted it on her website, so I just don't know if there's anybody that can do anything. I don't like it, though.
Do you know why they did it?
No, I don't know why they did it. They said,
well, I can tell you why they did it, because you weren't there. You weren't there, and they were teaching you a lesson for not being home. That's why they did it.
Well, it's not nice.
The idea that this is non-punitive, it is the public shaming. It is the stocks in the public square thing. And we've had some high courts, the U.S. Sixth Circuit and the highest courts of some states, Massachusetts, I want to say, have recognized it as such. And we can just hope that this sentiment spreads and to more jurisdictions and ultimately the U.S. Supreme Court. We had some indication in Packingham that they found it very disturbing that people who have completely served their sentences are still being subjected to these very onerous things that are not based on individual findings of actual dangerousness, but only on the offense of conviction.
So we need more litigation. Are you in Illinois? Are you in Illinois?
I'm in California.
You're in California. Well, there needs to be more litigation. Janice, her team, they're doing a lot. I would say approach them about this obnoxious visit and them sharing your photo with the neighbors and see what if she has anything to offer in the way of recourse. But it's done usually in retaliation. They've made a couple of visits or a number of visits and you're not there. And they say, well, in order to protect the safety of the community, we're going to make sure he still lives here. So they start asking, have you seen this guy? And if the people had said they had not seen you, then they would go back and use that as probable cause in their arrest warrant affidavit. And they would go back and say, well, we talked to three different neighbors and we showed a photograph and they said they hadn't seen the guy for 3 weeks. Of course, you're not obligated to be at home at any time during those 3 weeks, but that's neither here nor there.
I have a practical suggestion. It's maybe not as satisfactory as suing the bastards, but there is an inexpensive device that you see it advertised on television. It's called Ring, and it's a doorbell, and someone presses your doorbell. It rings your cell phone and immediately Skypes you with that person, and you can see who it is, and you can talk to them. So you would never have they would never have the excuse of being able to say, well, we couldn't find you at home and we didn't know whether you were still actually living there, and so we needed to investigate whether you had moved without permission and were no longer living there, that sort of thing. So there are practical things you can do to avoid that. Yeah,
that's a great idea. I just think that, you know, if we take some money from them, that the taxpayers are wasting doing these stupid searches, it would make a bigger dent in it.
It would be a lot less satisfying for them, because then they wouldn't be able to go around. They wouldn't have an excuse to go around showing your photograph to the neighbors and having the television come out and cover them doing it. What complete publicity hogs they tend to be.
So,
gentlemen,
thank you very much.
Thanks.
Gentlemen?
Yeah, is that Jim back?
Do you hear me? Yeah, I just had one last question for you. Hello?
Okay. Yes.
Yes.
If I move forward on my own on challenging the law on ex post the verification requirement on ex post facto grounds, I may not be the best litigant for this, number one. And number two, there may be, even though I understand that there are a lot of states that have worse things or in-house, whatever, in police station verification. But if there are other states that are similar to Connecticut, then if I do challenge it and lose, I screw it up for everybody who's affected. And there are 5,200 sex offenders in Connecticut alone. So, you know, given my lack of ability to get resources other than Google, LexisNexis, I ask whether or not there may be some way of canvassing the community to find out if there's an interest in challenging this type of Connecticut-type statute verification requirement, and if there'd be other people prepared to support it.
Well, I would say this, that there are people and organizations, and NARSOL the first among them, who are prepared to support viable challenges on constitutional basis to the punitive aspects of sex offender laws. And that is a blessing. Every now and then there are plaintiffs who have resources and are willing to spend them, or a big public interest lawyer firm that wants to take on a cause, and they try to cherry pick the ones they think they can win. Paul Dubling, who was on the earlier part of the show, is someone who is recruited by Glenn Girding, the appellate defender of North Carolina, to do a civil impact litigation in North Carolina against some aspects of the laws there. And so this is a movement that's kind of just getting off the ground and beginning to see some results. And so, in fact, one of the things that NARSOL, they call it SLAP, SLAP program, S-L-A-P, which the Scarlet Legal Action Project. And Larry Neely and I will be exhibiting in Las Vegas at Planet Hollywood in November this year again. We did it last year to promote this program to attorneys who have a civil practice, to try to encourage them to take interest in taking on these kinds of cases for reduced remuneration, the goodness of their hearts, or the hope of attorney's fees. There have been some very considerable attorney's fees awards in the millions of dollars. Though there's isn't it a $4 million?
I do have what I believe is a very valid Fourth Amendment claim as well, unreasonable search and seizure. I don't want to get into any detail on that, so there is potential legal fees here. But my point is, I spent probably in excess of $5,000 doing the district court filing was $850. Doing the appellate court filing, I spent $2,500 on a specialty firm to do the printing for the Supreme Court and mail it out. So I'm prepared to do that again. I don't have a problem spending another $5,000. What I have a problem doing it is without a little bit of backup expert advice, like maybe Dubling, to say, you know, you can do it, but you're not going to win, or you got 50%, or these are the potential drawbacks. Like you guys just pointed out, it could be worse. And I understood that it could be worse. But that's not really what I'm not going to do what if on that basis. I am going to do what if, you know, the likelihood of not winning. That's another issue. You know, that would be enough for me to say, well, maybe then forget that part of it. That's all I'm saying. So
One of the concerns about pro se litigants is the possibility of making bad law. I don't think you would make bad law for this. Although here's the risk is if the right arguments weren't made or it went up without the right record, then there is a tendency of courts, if the same issue comes along, maybe on a better record and with better argument, for them to say, we already looked at that issue and it didn't go anywhere. And so
exactly.
That might.
I don't want to do that on this issue if somebody else who's got more authority and more knowledge says, there's actually some valid validity here, so let's take it a little bit more seriously than just having you do it all alone on Google as pro se.
Yeah, and that's one of the benefits of Norisol is that you can get the advice of thoughtful people like Robin, who has a whole lot of legal knowledge, and Larry Neely has a whole lot of legal knowledge for two people who technically aren't lawyers, but they have certainly very good legal minds. I would put their legal minds up against many of the fine lawyers that I know. And then there are lawyers that they work with and who have been persuaded to participate in cases around the country. So it is good to come to them with your ideas and get their advice. I think their advice is uniquely good in this subject matter.
Okay, but the advice is maybe you're going to win, but we don't care whether you win or lose, because if you lose, it's no big deal to us. I'm just trying to get a sense.
No, if you win, that's great. And for you to be able to win, they'd have to see something deficient about the process, and it would raise their consciousness generally about how stupid many of these schemes are, you know. And the more the courts are thinking about that, the better, and they are starting to think about it.
Right. So that again, and I think there is something stupid about this process where they felonize late mail. That's what they're doing. They're felonizing late mail. It has nothing to do with verification. They are felonizing late mail. There are much easier ways to confirm residency than saying if you're a day late with your letter, you've got a strict liability Class D felony charge that you can be convicted on, and the high score in the state of Connecticut says, yes, it's strict liability. So
has it actually happened to you? Did you actually get the charge?
My question, because yeah. I was charged,
and I got it dismissed. You can't bring that because I brought a Fourth Amendment claim as well, and you can't bring one of those without getting the charge dismissed. And he wasn't going to get a jury to convict me of late mail.
And your travel is chilled. You're chilled by the possibility that this could happen again. I mean, but you would need someone with a strong background in civil rights litigation, constitutional right, to see what rights are being impaired here and help you frame the right petition or complaint.
I agree. I mean, it is relatively simple here. Yeah, I agree. But it is relatively simple here because there's not a lot of jurisprudence on these sex offender registration laws. So you might be able to reach back, but it's almost not really as relevant as what's there already. And what's there already is pretty clear, at least from the limited analysis and study and research I've done so far, which is that this is supposed to be non-punitive, and it's supposedly under Kennedy Mendoza, you've got to go through the tests. And this just fails the test. It's not only irrational, it's excessive. So
even if we
pretend that all the legislator has to say is that, well, we intend it to be regulatory, even though they could have enacted 1,500 different ways of it being a whole lot less punitive, even if that says, okay, well, the Supreme Court will say, well, they're good. All they got to do is say it's regulatory, and it is regulatory. There's still the Kennedy-Mendoza tests.
Right. It can be punitive in effect if it has a punitive effect, even if it didn't have a punitive intent. But then they want to know what right has been impaired. So that has to be articulated well. I would say that there is more jurisprudence available now. And what there is, Norisol is the clearinghouse and the repository of it. And I certainly look to them and all of the resources that they have, the other attorneys that they deal with, for templates and jurisprudence in anything that I would attempt.
Well, that's exactly why I called in, just to see if there's someone who could help organize that for me.
Well, you've come to the right place. We'll circulate your petition
and
see what traction gets.
Cindy, as you know, knows how to get in touch with me. So if I am intending to proceed, I've been kind of sitting on it, waiting for some guidance from Norisol. But I've got, I think it's a 2-year statute of limitations on the Fourth Amendment claim. And the other one is I could bring at any point. So I'm going to do the, you know, within the 2 years, because I'm going to bring a Fourth Amendment claim as well, which, again, might be if some lawyer thinks, okay, your Fourth Amendment claim is not bad, and we could get damages that might motivate them to actually pick up the other part of the claim as well. There'd be two claims, a Fourth Amendment claim and the ex post facto claim.
And one thing that you bring that many litigants don't bring is a little bit of financial resources. And so if you really wanted to do the most good in your state, then you might be able to be paired with someone who has already studied that, Connecticut's overall scheme for that, and would know what the low-hanging fruit is in Connecticut and pair you.
We're gonna take one more call and wrap it up, because we're actually 25 minutes past, so we're going of our conclusion time. So, Jim, you can stay on. This is the last call of the night, 847. You're on with King Alexander.
Yeah, you guys were talking earlier about Illinois, and I'm sorry I joined in late, but I've been on the registry now in Illinois for about 8.5 years, and the Itasca Police Department is well aware of me. They know exactly who I am, and yet every Halloween, I live with my parents, unfortunately, because of the way the situation works. Every Halloween, they harass my parents. They stick a squad car outside my parents' house every year. Even though they know my car, they know where I am, they know where I work, they know my hours, and they still stick somebody outside. I just wanted to jump in earlier. Unfortunately, again, I hide myself in the shadows. I kept myself away. I waited until things were over. And I just, you know, earlier there was things that you could talk about, you know, being able to report things like that. I would like to be able to report that the Itasca Police Department harasses the crap out of my parents, who also, my father was on the board of directors of the town. So it's kind of weird.
That is, you know, that brings up something that is a subject of something that I looked at. Actually, one of the ones, it's Bethea is the case, and that's a writ application that Narsal is participating in amicus now. Is that right, Larry? Bethea is about the effect of this stuff on people like the parents, like the children, like the employers, people who aren't convicted of anything, but who are having these horrific consequences from these ridiculous schemes. And I can tell you why they're doing this. They're not necessarily doing it because of you. They're doing it to make a showing to the community of, look, we're vote for me, sheriff, because I protect you from the big bad sex offenders. You know, that's what they're doing. And they probably have a little bit of sadistic joy in harassing you or your parents vicariously, but it's more about making a showing and justifying their existence, their budget, the taxes they get, and so on. And it is stupid.
I completely understand that. And our town has been hit with a couple of slight weather events over the last like couple of years. And I'm the first person out there to go help everybody, you know, pick up the branches, you know, put their roof back together. I mean, the entire neighborhood knows who I am. I'm here. To them, it's not a problem. But for some reason, the police department seems to think that, you know, no matter what, they have to harass the living crap out of, the people that are willing to house me during this time. And it's just something that I honestly don't think should be going on. And believe me, the past caller, he said he wants to go up against the courts. I mean, I've beaten the courts a couple of times as far as leaving the state is concerned, going on vacation is concerned. I mean, I would love to get involved more, but I don't want to subject my parents to the harassment even more than they've already getting.
Right, I understand. And one of the things that registration does is hammer the registrant into abject poverty and limitation of where they can live and so on. So it is hard because they make you more reliant on family, and then they punish your family while they're at it. Let's see. I'm looking in my computer now to see what jurisdiction was involved in the Bethea case. And do you happen to know that offhand, Robin?
That's one of Robin's cases.
Yeah, I see it. I find the Narsal amicus brief, and the Ilya, not Ilya Soman, but the Ilya Shapiro also appeared in that for the Cato Institute, libertarian think tank. Let me see what state it comes out of.
I understand what you guys are doing, but I'm not looking to, you know, take on the Itasca Police Department. I mean, they're a bunch of hardliners in there. And,
it may be the only way to stop them. It may be they're not going to stop on their own volition. If somebody does, as we say, when they can they do that, they can do it until they're stopped.
Yeah, this is out of North Carolina, so Glenn Girding's hand is in this. Yeah, I can see
it's one of Robin's cases, but yeah. See, that's the catch 22 we're in. Is that there's two catch 22s, primarily is money, but when people want to stay under the rock and say, I don't like this, but is what doesn't stop it.
It's right.
I don't like this, and I realize that a ton of shit may come down on me, but I have to stand up and do something.
Right. And that's what, yeah, we don't recommend it for people who are still on probation or parole. Because they're more vulnerable.
I'm not on either one of those. I've been out of that for eight and a half years. I've only got 16 months to go, and I'm actually technically off the registry.
So they've only got 16 months left to harass your parents. You know, I mean, I bet they can't stand it.
Well, if you're getting off in 16 months, you may be able to ride it out. But people are on for a lifetime. They have no hope of getting off. They can't ride it out.
Yeah,
it's only going to get worse.
Yeah, you could be forgiven for just riding it out.
I've been more than willing to take on the cause. But like I said, it's just, you know, adding on the burden to them. You know, honestly, the house I own, I live 436 feet away from a school.
Yeah.
So for 64 feet, I have not been able to live in my own house that I own for the last 12 years. So,
oh boy.
You know, I'd love to take up the cause, but.
Well, maybe you can help in other ways after you're off the registry. Yeah, strike it rich and become a philanthropist.
So, well,
Larry,
on that note,
I've actually thought about running for state government because there's, you know, why not? You know, I mean, I'd be straight up honest and go, you know, hey, this is me. You know, you're going to get me who I am. There's no skeletons for me, so I'm going to do a lot for you people.
It would help to raise consciousness of the issue, if nothing else.
So, on that note, we're going to thank that caller. And, Robin, did you have a comment? Because we are 35 minutes past.
Yeah, I actually have a report relevant to Halloween.
Good.
I just got an email from our local news station here that a child has been struck by a car trick-or-treating this evening. So.
Was the car driven by a registered sex offender?
I'm hoping not. But this is real. That's true. It's true. I just got it. Came across the wire about 5 minutes ago. So it's an illustration of what we've tried to tell all the media people we've talked with today and yesterday, that this is really the threat that children face on Halloween.
Exactly.
So
I wrote to the local paper in my area about how many stranger perpetrator sex offenses against children on Halloween's here historically, and have the warnings made any difference?
So they have not, and it's craziness. But on that note, we're going to end our second Halloween Marathon Cop Watch program and pronounce it a smashing success.
All right, same time next year.
Hopefully we'll have more participation next year. We could have, rather than having over 100, we could have had 500 here tonight. And rather than having the number of attorneys we had, we could have had double that number. So we're going to need more attorneys. We're going to need more people to make this really work. We're going to have to take it to fight to these people. They're not going to stop on their own volition. They will stop when they're stopped. So any closing from you, King, for Robin, Brenda, anybody who's left here on the main control before we sign off?
Well, time flies while you're having fun.
It does indeed, but I've been sitting in this chair for 5.5 hours.
Yeah.
Oh, come on, man. I don't want to hear the 5.5 hours. I started at 2. I've been here for like 8.5 hours.
So Brenda has departed the scene, so Brenda's I just checked.
Long gone.
Yeah, she's gone. She's gone.
Well, thanks to Andy for the technical help.
Yeah,
I didn't do my homework and learn the program before we came on, but we managed to do it on the fly pretty well.
Not too bad.
And thanks for that.
And we've got 2 prize winners for the gift card, so I'm going to have to do some deciding on that, and I'll get in touch with the people in the coming days. So we end up having the number being in the mix twice, apparently. So we're going to have to deal with that. But thank everyone for being with us on this Halloween Cop Watch program, and it's been so well received. We will probably do it again, I'm guessing.
Awesome.
And Robin will be doing the hosting next year.
Oh, yeah. I can't wait. Oh, yeah. Well, have a good night. You did a great job, Larry. And thanks, King. Thanks, Andy.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Have a good night.
All righty. Well, I guess people that now they're in the queue. The queue is empty. But anybody on the call, thank you. There are still some left. We will be notifying you of any follow-up information, and we'll be notifying you for the next conference call.